You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Here at Ritual, we know that a mother's support isn't limited to one day a year. And we believe that yours shouldn't be either. So this Mother's Day, we're honoring the world's biggest supporters with science-backed daily rituals that center you not just today, but every day. Whether you're thinking about motherhood, actively trying, or already there, we've got you covered for when it matters most. From fertility support and natal choline to our best-selling clinically-backed prenatal multivitamin, know that you're getting clean, traceable key ingredients in bioavailable forms. Because let's be honest, you don't have time for guesswork. Find your ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator, as of Q4 2024 in top 5 products.
Oasis Podcast, Episode 12, Steve White. Welcome to the Oasis Podcast, episode 12. Thank you very much for all the response I've had to the last episode with Brian Garcia. It's been absolutely fantastic. It smashed all records. It was my most downloaded, my most listened to episode I've ever done. Beating even Brian's good friend, the other Brian, Brian Cannon. So that was quite a surprise. I think Brian Garcia was probably the most surprised of all. But you guys really showed out in your thousands, actually, and downloaded that episode and listened to it on the various places. So I just want to say thank you so much to everyone who's who downloaded that. So that's great. Please, if you're new to us through the Brian Garcia episode, go back and listen to the other ones. You can probably skip the first two, to be honest. That's just me kind of rambling on before I sort of got my head around what this is. So, so thank you so much for all the people that have got involved with that. It's been great. We've got a great episode coming up today. It's with Steve White. Now, Steve White, if you don't know, is the one of the leading drummers in the world, really. Definitely in the UK. And he was the drummer in a band called the Style Council throughout the 1980s with Paul Weller and Mick Talbot. And then he carried on to be Paul Weller's drummer all throughout the 90s and into the 2000s as well, and played on Stanley Road and Heavy Soul and all those great, great Paul Weller albums. And Steve is probably my favourite drummer, favourite living drummer, definitely. And so it was an absolute, absolute pleasure to get to speak to him. It was fantastic. Relating to Oasis, he played with Oasis in 2001 on the Brotherly Love Tour, as we talk about. And also his brother is Alan White, who was the Oasis drummer from, 95 to 2004, 2005. Yeah, so I was really pleased that Steve did actually talk about Alan a bit more. I did, before we started recording, I did ask him if he was happy enough with that, because I know Alan has kind of disappeared from the public eye a little bit. But no, Steve was great. He was happy to talk a little bit about Alan, which is absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much to everyone that's been in touch. On emails, on the Twitter, on the Facebook as well. Facebook, I've finally relented and set that up, and so I've been spending a bit of time over on there. So I've had some wonderful messages. I'll just give a few shout outs. Jordan Burnside, Chris Petey, Joe Ryan, Ross Hayes, The Andersons, The Volunteers, Rob at the Britpop Store, Stu Evans, Steve Buchanan, Sam Huxley, Robert Nodding, Christopher Robinson, Felix Black, Fergus Dowd, Cody Johansson, and of course everyone else that's been in touch. Everyone else has been in touch on Twitter. Thank you so much. I have really appreciated it. And as I said, that's what this podcast is all about. It's about creating a community of Oasis fans, of music fans. And yeah, so please do get in touch. One of the things that we're looking to do, so a lot of the people I've mentioned have sort of offered to provide support and help in the podcast where we can. And there's loads of different skill sets out there, from graphic design to music to editing to loads of stuff. And so, yeah, I'm definitely going to be taking people up on that, because yeah, I'd love to keep up to the doing one or two episodes a week. And with everything else I've got going on, that's just not really possible. But maybe with your guys' help, that would be possible. So what we're doing is setting up kind of like a brain trust of people that are happy to help the podcast and happy to get involved. So if you want to get involved with that, then please drop me an email, oasispod@gmail.com, or a direct message on the Twitter or on the Facebook Oasis podcast page. One of the downsides of the Brian Garcia interview doing so well is that my hosting charges of Podomatic have actually just shot up. So I haven't kind of talked about Patreon really up to this point, but I think I'm going to push this a little bit more now. So if you really like the podcast and you think you'd like to support the podcast, then feel free to head over to patreon.com/oasispod, and you can become a patron of the podcast, which means it's in dollars because it's an American site. But you can chuck me as little as sort of a dollar a month, basically whatever you feel comfortable, what you think is fair for what we provide via the Oasis podcast. And yeah, if you'd be happy to do that, then we'll be happy to take your donation. I'm not looking to make any money from this. All I want to do really is cover the costs of hosting the podcast. And as it gets bigger, as I use more bandwidth and storage, those costs shoot up. So I really want to. So if I can cover my costs, that would be absolutely fantastic. So yeah, if you do want to do that, then head over to Patreon and check that out. I've also put some interesting reward levels. Now, one of them being a bit weird, which is we will record you a bespoke song. So if you pick the reward level of $3 or more per month, then I will record a song for you. Now, we've had some people like Christopher Robinson, who's a great musician, and he's been willing to sort of lay down a track. I'll find out a bit more about you, find out a bit about your life, and we will do a bespoke Oasis style song about you. Now, how's that? That sounds pretty cool for, you know, a few dollars a month, less than you probably spend on a coffee or a pint. Anyway, one of our guys who's got in touch previously, we played one of his tracks, was Ross Hayes, who goes under Hazed on YouTube. He's put together a brand new mix of Gas Panic, which is really cool. So I think I'd like to drop in a little bit here. Yeah. And while we're on the new music tip as well, Simon Wilcox, who is at The Rockstar, at T-H-E-R-O-C-K-S-T-A, has been in touch. He's also a musician. He does some really cool Oasis covers, and he pinged me over this cover of It's Good to Be Free. So let's have a little bit of this.
Head like a rock spinning round and round. I found it in a hole sitting upside down. You point the finger at me, but I don't believe. And pay me a wish on a velvet sky. You demand the answers, I don't know why. In my mind, there is no time. The little things, they make me so happy. All I wanna do is live by the sea. The little things, they make me so happy. But it's good. Yes, it's good, it's good to be free.
So I just wanted to run something else by you guys. I've been approached to move the podcast over to a quite a big podcast network. At the moment where I am, I have to pay physically to have the podcast out there. And then also, depending on how popular it is, you have to pay more. And because it's done so well over the last couple of weeks, actually the costs of hosting the podcast have shot up quite a bit. So the interesting thing is that if I was to move my podcast over to this network, it doesn't cost me anything. And it's funded because that network has advertising. So I just wanted to run it by you. So please get in touch at Oasis Podcast and let me know what you think about that. And that's on Twitter or Facebook. How would you feel about me moving the podcast somewhere else that's going to have advertising on there? It's better for me because it's not going to cost me any money. And it's also being part of that big network. We'll probably get some good opportunities, more promotion, which probably means better guests and things like that. So that would be great. The other downside to it is that the legal amount of music you can play on a podcast is actually 30 seconds per clip. I've kind of just been getting away with it and playing, you know, whole tracks or, you know, 90 seconds, couple of minutes, whatever I felt was right. So if I go ahead and do this, I'm going to be limited to playing 30 seconds clips. Now I can sort of break that up, maybe play 30 seconds, talk for a bit, play another 30 seconds. I'm not quite sure, but yeah, I just wanted to get that out there. I'm not going to make any decision yet because I really wanted to see what that you guys feel about it. So let me know, get in touch, yeah, we'll see what we do. And a couple of other quick reminders. Please do rate, review the podcast. A nice 5-star rating would be wonderful, as I've always said. Thank you so much for everyone that's been going out and doing those reviews. It's absolutely brilliant. And I'd be remiss to not mention what happened in Manchester a couple of days ago. I'm not going to dwell on it because it's not my place, but obviously all our podcast listeners were very affected by that. Manchester means a lot to us. And our thoughts are definitely with all those affected in Manchester. Right, enough of this. Let's crack on with some music. And then after this, the incredible Mr. Steve White.
Yeah.
Steve, how are you doing?
I'm very, very good today, thank you, James. All good here in sunny South London.
In sunny South London. Is it sunny? It's pouring down here in just outside Reading.
It's not sunny, but I just like to call it sunny South London. It makes me feel better.
Oh, fair enough. Well, yeah, all our listeners in Los Angeles and stuff. Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous here. There's lovely May and
I'm jealous.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Oasis podcast. As I say, I do really appreciate it. Been a massive fan of your work from as long as I can remember, really. I've got a sister and a brother that's 10 and 11 years older than me that were massive Style Council fans. So I grew up with that, the Style Council in the car and things. I'm a Britpop kid, really. So for me, getting into your stuff was really mid 90s stuff, which I'm sure a lot of people would have been. So yeah, real honoured to speak to you. So I do really appreciate you taking the time today, mate.
Pleasure.
Good. So what are you up to? What are you up to at the moment, really? What's happening in the world of Steve White right now?
Just constantly working at the moment. I teach quite a bit. I teach at Trinity in London, and I teach at Goldsmiths University and Leeds College of Music, and then I have a sort of quite healthy students that come from all over the world. I've just had a guy over from Bangkok that's doing some studying, and somebody that's come over from New Zealand to study, and I really enjoy that. So that's going well, and then I'm working towards a new EP with our band, the Family Silver, with Damon Michella and Matt Dayton, who stepped in and played with Oasis for a bit in, back in the day.
Yep.
And then I'm looking to go up to Sheffield next week to work with two fine gentlemen called Chris Haig and Joel White on a really lovely psychedelic soul project that we've been working on for a couple of months. Which I'm looking for that to come out, and then recording a Family Silver EP, and then I'm going out to do some classes and some these in-conversation events at Glasgow Jazz Festival. So that's sort of really, that's me kind of up till Christmas now, really, sort of busy.
Really busy. No, that's great. I mean, when I did an interview with Mark Feltham, and he was sort of saying that, the harmonica player.
I love Mark.
Yeah, and he was saying that, like, the days of sort of the session musician are kind of, they're struggling now. You're just not getting the same level of work as it's people doing sort of bits and pieces in their bedrooms and things like that.
I saw that coming. I mean, I saw the writing on the wall for that, and decided to change my my career path accordingly, because I just saw that, what was happening and what streaming was going to do, and I just moved in a different direction and I'm really glad I did, because it's paid off. So I'm not unhappy about that. I'm not sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. When stuff comes my way that I want to do, I don't really worry about money. I just go and do it because I want to do it.
Great.
That's kind of the best way to be, really.
No, absolutely. And what I thought I saw on your website, I didn't realise this, but this is such a cool idea. That if you're a musician, you've put together a demo, a track, you can send it over to you and you'll play drums on it. How cool is that?
It's cool, but I mean, it's not free and it's not 50 quid, so that puts some people off. Beyond the initial inquiries, it's really aimed at pro bands. I get a fair few inquiries from abroad about that, and that kind of works out. And if I do it, I'll tend to sort of go to a studio and do it properly, and I've got to like the music as well. So,
of course,
it's just one of the things that I do, that, trying to embrace a bit of technology and recognize the internet actually exists it's just on there, and if people want to do it, they can pay for the studio and a bit for me, then it's something that I can offer.
No, I just thought it was such a cool idea to say, oh yeah. Yeah, Steve White played drums on my album. Yeah, I just, so cool to be able to get that. So taking it back, to the start for you, really. So, I mean, you grew up in, is it South London you grew up?
Yes, much different place then. It's very nice now. I grew up in South London, playing around the clubs and pubs and bars and conservative clubs and Labour clubs and Liberal clubs and dances and you know, all these kind of things that I did as a kid.
Yeah.
Which kind of helped me to work out how to play song structures, which came in handy when I started working. And then I got the chance to play with the Style Council, you know, just before my 18th birthday. So I was still 17 when I did my first gig with them. And kind of intermittently worked with Paul for a fair few years. Did some stuff away, playing with James Taylor Quartet and Ian Dury and Working Week and different bands from Galliano from that time, and fronted my own band and went off travelling to Japan and did some stuff out there with my own band, and then went back to work with Paul when he went solo, and that took up 10-12 years.
And
then we kind of finished up working together in 2006-07, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on to, you know, that's when I sort of thought, you know, the internet's going to make a really big impact on music, so I've got to do something else. So I started to develop my teaching, but I also went out on the road with John Lord from Deep Purple.
Mm-hmm.
who has a you know, I first met in person at Wheeler's End, which is the studio that obviously Noel had, so there's a connection there.
There we go.
And I did some stuff with John, and then I did some bobs with LaRue and management. I manage a young artist that put a couple of records out that I produced, and now he's writing. He's just had a track that's got 20 million streams on Spotify, so, you know, that's a different thing to do.
Blimey.
And then I did the Trio Valore. We did lots of shows in Italy with Damon Michella.
Mm-hmm.
Seamus Behan, and then a guy called Justin Sheehan, and then Matt Dayton came and played with us at a gig in Aberystwyth, and we decided to do some writing, and that's how the first Family Silver album came about. And now we're working with a little label called Monk's Road, which is run by a friend of ours called Richard Clark, and we've put one album out called Electric Blend, and now we're just about to record a new EP, and then we do a UK tour in November and December this year. So
no, great.
Come down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I really like the first album, and I think Matt Dayton is such an underrated songwriter and singer. Yeah, he's you know, he's just one of those guys that, I don't know, because Mother Earth, I think, as well, was such an underrated band. And I think it's that they came through maybe before the sort of Britpop boom.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? And so they were kind of lumped in with that sort of early, slightly earlier sort of acid jazz scene, and didn't kind of get the rewards that a lot of the Britpop bands got, I thought, that they really deserved.
No, they were a very, very good band. I mean, but they were kind of towards the end of that whole acid jazz thing, just as the Britpop thing was about to explode. I mean, you know, there were a few bands, you know, that were on that were slightly ahead of their time and ended up, you know, ended up sort of missing out on the whole kind of Britpop explosion. But, you know, that's the way the old cookie crumbles, I'm afraid.
No, absolutely. And yeah, so growing up, you were obviously playing the drums, and your little brother Alan was did he copy you? Was he nicking your drum kit, or did you have a drum kit each in the house?
Well, because because he's that much younger, I mean, when I, by the time that Alan really started to show interest in the drums, I'd moved out, I'd got my own place, and I was gigging and touring. So all of my old bits and bobs that were still left at my mum's house, he kind of acquired the very first Pearl kit that he was using when he first started working with Oasis. That was one of my old drum sets, and then he also had the Rogers kit that ended up on the front cover of, I think, Don't Look Back in Anger.
Yeah,
that was something that he bought while he was working at Foots in London, and I would put a bits of work his way. Like, he got to play with Dr. Robert.
Yes,
did some recording with Robert before he joined Oasis, and he played some Depp gigs with Galliano for me as well, and he went and Depped on a Gabrielle single that I was booked to play on, and Alan did that. So he was kind of coming through behind me, and then obviously he just finished in Japan with Robert, with Dr. Robert, and came back, and that's when the notorious meeting, or you know, call happened, and he joined Oasis.
Yeah, I mean, how did you feel to see your little brother like get that call to the big leagues? Because I mean, they were already, you know, they had a number one single like when he joined, you know.
Yeah, it was strange. I mean, I first met the band when I was doing the White Room.
Another marriage made in the White Room now, as Noel out of Oasis joins a bloke who's been making great records since the Jam's debut single of 1977. 18 years of growing up in public, and still no one's seen him smile on the telly. Perhaps tonight's the night. Paul Weller, Noel Gallagher.
Right, this one's called Talk Tonight.
Tony and Quigsy and Bonehead, and I got on really well with everybody. I'm still really good friends with Bonehead to the day. We still see each other, you know, quite regularly because of my connections in Manchester. And Tony McCarroll is someone that I've stayed in touch with and intermittently, and I think I've sent an invite out to Tony to come down to my little event in June in Manchester, because he's a great guy. I loved his book as well. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, really lovely, wasn't it?
Excellent. And, you know, so I met them then, and I kind of got sort of a strange wind that something was afoot. I didn't write too much because it wasn't my business in band politics. But essentially, it wasn't too long after we did the White Room that it became apparent that Tony was going to be replaced. And the way I kind of hear the story is that I think Paul Weller did mention to Noel that my brother was a drummer, and you know, was a good drummer, and I don't know if Noel took it on board, but I'm pretty sure I'm sure there are people out there that know much more about me than me, but I'm pretty sure that Noel heard Alan playing on a with another creation artist, Ida, I think was signed to Creation, and Alan was doing some session work with her in a studio in Fulham, and I think Noel heard the drumming and asked Alan McGee, who's that playing drums? And it was Alan, and he said, oh, is that Alan, that's Steve's brother? Yes, I think it is. So that's where the connection was actually made. And then I think, you know, Noel managed to get hold of my mum's number and left a message with my mum for Alan to call. And
no Twitter or Facebook back then, was there?
No, he phoned up and spoke to my mum. That was it. That's how it happened. I remember my mum saying, well, I think this bloke Noel Gallagher's just phoned up for you, Alan. And that was it, really. And then he went down to do a rehearsal, and they liked what they heard, obviously. And then the next thing, he was, I think they were doing, they did a Plymouth Pavilions or something like that. And then they were doing Glastonbury. And that was kind of very, very soon into his tenure with the band. He just grabbed the ball by the horns and went for it. And I told him, because when he said to me about that he was going to do an audition, I said, well, look, just get everything you can of the bands, learn it all, find out, you know, if there's B-sides, learn them. And I think he went for the audition. And I don't know if they played anything by Oasis. They played Beatles tunes.
Probably, yeah.
So that was it. And I mean, I'm sure that, you know, that's been elaborated on over the years, but that's kind of the skeleton of what the way I remember it all happening. And then that was it. I mean, he was gone. I think the next time I saw him was towards the end of July, and we did a festival in Switzerland called Out in the Green with REM were on, and Bo Diddley was on, and Cheryl Cole was on. Cheryl Cole was on.
Cheryl Crow.
I get my Cheryls mixed up. You know, all lovely fellas. Cheryl Crow was on. And it was I got to meet Bo Diddley, which was cool.
Cool.
And that was the next time that I saw him, and we had a few drinks, and they played us in the back of the coach. They took us upstairs and played us What's the Story, and said, what do we think? And we were like, I think that's going to do all right.
yeah, just about.
And then he disappeared and went to Japan and America, and I just really, for that first couple of years, it would be Christmas, New Year's and birthdays. That's, you know, because he was busy. I was still doing, I mean, that kind of 95, 96 period, we were just constantly working. So, yeah. That was a really crazy time.
Mm. No, that's great. And obviously what you were doing with Weller at the time as well was just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we were sort of promoting Stanley Road, which, you know, I mean, people sometimes don't kind of realise. I mean, that sold over 2 million records in the UK, you know, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But, an Ocean Colour Scene and Damon and Steve were around, and yeah, it was a really good time. You know, it was a really good time for bands, and we had a lot of fun at that time.
Yeah, and I mean, and we sort of skipped over the Style Council, which I think often does happen. You know, people, especially, I think the problem with the Style Council was it wasn't the Jam, right? And so everyone loved the Jam so much, but I find myself going back to the Style Council quite a lot, and I'll get myself into just a Style Council period because they're, when you go back to them now, especially with Weller's writing, there was times in the Jam and solo stuff, but his writing around them was so sophisticated, and the structures and the lyrics as well. I think he hit a real creative peak in that time, I think.
I think he reacted really well to having, a little bit of the weight taken off his shoulders with the, you know, with essentially a core of a band, you know, with Mick and myself and Dee and he would play demos to me and I think a lot of drummers would come up with a fairly conventional beat, and I'd come up with some sort of bossa nova or a Latin groove, and I think he really liked that. I think he thought it was really what he needed, and it certainly was for the first couple of albums, which I'm still incredibly proud of, and there's parts of Confessions of a Pop Group that are fantastic, and then I think that probably, you know, Paul, Mick, they kind of lost interest and things happened. I can't put words into their mouths as to why it took so long for the band to you know, to eventually fold. But even when Paul did that house record, that obviously getting into like house music, and I again I saw the writing on the wall. I thought, well, if he's into getting into house music, then he's not going to need a drummer, is he?
So absolutely.
That's when I went and joined the James Taylor Quartet for a year and toured with them and just, you know, I kind of saw the writing and just thought, oh, I better get, it's a good time to go, really. And then you know, they did that house record, which, you know, in all honesty, even though the label kind of didn't like it, it was a really, really brave and quite ahead of time thing to do.
Absolutely.
You know, so, you know, good for him, really. It's you know, he's never been one to, you know, at that time he was never one to shy away from taking a chance. So, you know, that's amazing. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience.
But then obviously you then come back into the fold throughout that whole 90s period. And
yeah, because I think if I'd have gone back to do the, because they did ask me to come back, and then a lot of people think, like, you know, well, he didn't do that tour, because I missed a couple of tours over that time. But, you know, when a band's kind of taking extended sort of periods off, you know, people like myself at the time, well, you know, you need to work.
Absolutely.
So I would go off and do something, and then eventually it would clash with what Stylecastle were doing. And so, you know, they got other drummers in, and then I'd come back. But on the last time when they went to Japan and did that at the Albert Hall, I simply wasn't around. I was working myself, and it, with James in Italy, I think we were. And I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't walk out on a tour and come back to do that. And I explained that to Paul. And I think that the reason that I think I worked really well with him in the early days when he went solo is because I'd not done that last Stylecastle thing. I think if I'd been around for the final sort of death throes of the band, then maybe he wouldn't have considered me for the next venture, because we'd had a year or two's break. And then I remember, I just met up for a sporadic coffee, and he just said, oh, you know, do you fancy playing on some demos? And I remember saying, not if it's all drum machines, I don't know. He was like, no, it won't be. And then we went down to, we went to Ronnie Scott's to see a Cuban band called Irakire, and Paul said, I've got this tune that I want, I think that brass section would be amazing on, and it's called Here's a New Thing, and that's the brass from Cuban band Irakire on that. And but the bass drum on it, Pete Wilson, the producer, wanted to program it, and I was like, oh, really? It's that kind of thing again. I don't know if I want to do it. And then Paul said, oh, well, you know, it's fine, we'll just see how it goes. Then he just said to me, I've got this new song that I want to demo, and I really want to get it done this weekend. And so we went in over an Easter weekend, and that was into tomorrow, and there was no program on it. It was just played. It was just all the band in the studio. I think Dr. Robert might have been on bass on it. If it wasn't, it was Marco Nelson, and I apologise. And we just played it, and it just felt, this is kind of it, you know. Mm. First album for Pony Canyon, and no money being around, and, you know, just only being signed in Japan because you couldn't get a deal in the UK.
It's crazy, then, isn't it, to think of that now?
Yeah, I know, it's amazing. And then things just grew and grew, and that period of time, that late 89 to 1996, we just worked and worked and worked and worked, you know, and it was brilliant. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, until at the end we were playing at, you know, two sold out nights, 40,000 at Finsbury Park, you know.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Don Valley Stadium, Crystal Palace Stadium, you know, Victoria Park with Ian Dury. Just incredible, really.
No, it's fantastic. And that's and the funny thing we were saying about, you know, you mentioned about Damon and Matt Dayton, is that every, like, so Matt Dayton had had that sort of quick call in for Oasis in 2000 when, you know, to replace Noel for a bit. You had it in 2001, and the odd one out is Damon Minchella, because he was approached to go and play bass after Grigsy left, but then turned it down.
Yeah, he did. I, you know, we were good friends with Grigsy, and I just don't know if well, we are good friends with Grigsy, and I just don't know if it, Damon felt that it was appropriate, really, you know. So, you know, but probably, I'm not really sure about that, but yeah, no, he turned it down. So, yeah, we've all kind of had a, you know, I mean, Damon's played on, you know, many times and shared a stage with Liam and Noel at LM shows and, you know, bits and pieces. So we all kind of knew each other and, you know, obviously OCS supported Oasis quite a bit at that time. I think Rob Lohman, we were on and, yeah, so we got, you know, we had a fairly kind of close history at that time, and yeah, I mean, I went and did the Brotherly Love tour that we did with Space Hog and the Black Crows, and became sort of really ever since sort of buddies with Steve Gorman from the Black Crows and Chris and Rick, and loved it. I had an absolutely brilliant time. I really really enjoyed that tour.
Was it quite cool? Just sort of, you know, getting to do a holiday as a member of Oasis, like, and then, you know, then sort of shake hands and off you go at the end of it.
Yeah, basically, that was kind of it, really. I had an afternoon's rehearsal, which wasn't very long, a couple of hours rehearsal, and then I took some cassettes away and listened to some songs, and then asked a few questions when we got to Las Vegas when we did the first sound check, and then we did it. We just went for it, and then, you know, I think there's some footage of us at the Greek Theatre that's on YouTube, of me playing with a band, and it sounded pretty good, I think. It sounded quite sort of, good.
Well, we've done, we did an episode a couple ago where we were looking at sort of the history of Oasis Live, and actually that is often picked out as kind of one of the peaks of the band, because it was pretty early in Gem and Andy's career, so they were sort of pretty new into it and just starting to put their sort of spin on things, so it was starting to mix it up a little bit more. Obviously they as players I think had a bit more freedom and things to do it, rather than sort of Bonehead and Grigsy, which just, you know, by obviously from an outsider's point of view, just kept pretty much to what they were told to do, whereas it starts to mix up a little bit more with Gem and Andy, and Gem's doing a bit more lead and Andy's doing a bit more on the bass. And then also the fact that that tour wasn't in support of an album, so it's like a best of with a couple of the tracks from Standing on the Shoulder of Giants coming in. So the set list is phenomenal at that time as well.
It was great. And it was, you know, there was no problems, there was no tantrums, there was no kind of, you know, falling outs. It was, I remember a lot of great nights of not only playing, but, you know, just seeing parts of America. And, you know, I remember going off in a taxi to watch The Mummy 2 with Liam in Kentucky. You know, it was like taking him out for Thai food in New York. It was a really it was quite a long tour. It was like 5 or 6 weeks, I think it was. But you know, but it was really good and really good fun, I thought that, you know, I didn't know that Oasis fans were particularly aware that I'd sort of stood in for one tour, but it's nice to know that they do know, because it doesn't, you know, I've never been really kind of mentioned in dispatches for my association with the band, you know, and obviously it's my brother that people associate with the band. So it's nice to know that fans, you know, that it's out there on the, you know, the gigs out there on the Greek Theatre thing. People can see it if they want to, you know, because I really enjoyed it.
No, well, it's also, there was quite a lot of backstage filming and stuff done, and they put them out as a series of little documentaries on sort of the DVDs of the singles.
What's his name? The filmmaker with the big moustache.
I'm not sure who did that off the top of my head. But and so those are out there, and those have been sort of collated into one thing on YouTube now. So there's actually... there isn't actually that lots of, there isn't huge amounts of footage of sort of Oasis in sort of backstage sort of candid moments, and yet there is on that tour actually. So that's, you know, you're a bit more visible than you might think because of that stuff being out there, Steve.
I'll have to check that out. I've never seen that. Maybe send me a link.
Yeah, I will. I'll send you a link. There's a bit when you're explaining the different drumming styles of Noel sort of asking you, I think Gem's asking you, well, why do some drummers hold the a drumstick like inside their hand rather than holding it?
Yeah. Why did Mitch Mitchell play like that and John Bonham not? John Bonham did.
John Bonham did in the early days, but he was like, what it is, it's really boring. The reason it's played like that, this is probably the best way to play the drums, right? But the reason that drummers play like that is because it all comes from the military. And the side drum would have been on the side like of your shoulder, and it's hard to play like that.
Okay.
So they developed it playing like that. And it really comes down to who taught you. Because some drummers, and a lot of those drummers like Mitch Mitchell, were taught probably by older jazz drummers.
Right.
So they would have been shown like that, but just kept it.
They got rock school for today,
Till. There you go. I've told you, it's nothing radical.
Drum workshop.
Episode 2. How to piss off the rest of the band.
You caught it for once.
I remember that. It was in a dressing room, I think in Boston, actually.
Oh, really?
There you go. Yeah, I think it was.
Good. And then, so when the... And then you've gone back, and as I say, after that, you've done loads of stuff. There's The Players, there's Trio Valore.
Yeah.
I mean, Trio Valore stuff I really like as well. And for me, it's sort of, it reminds me of like the David Holmes sort of, Ocean's 11 soundtrack, just sort of cool music. It's so cinematic to me, that stuff. It's whatever it is, it's sort of, you know, every track will be like, okay, this is sort of, you know, an Italian gangster film, or this is, or whatever. Yeah, each track has its own kind of cinematic feel. Was that the thinking behind it?
Well, definitely, because I love the sound of the Hammond organ. I've got a passion for Hammond, and I've just done a record, ironically, with Mikey Rowe playing Hammond on.
Oh yeah.
And Matt Dayton playing guitar on with a singer called Bill Fay. And there was a couple of tunes where Mikey kind of let loose on the Hammond, and I'm like, because he's a fantastic player.
Yep.
And I just love that sound. And that, exactly, we were kind of really into, the Booker T and the MGs and the kind of spaghetti western kind of stuff, and not too muso-y, but just that Hammond kind of vibe. Did a few shows, and to be honest with the trio, it never really kind of clicked in this country, because people would rather go and see a tribute band to Weller than something sort of
that was
instrumental in this country. But we went to Italy a lot. We were in Italy, we went to Spain, we did loads of shows out there, which was absolutely, you know, being in Italy during the height of summer, having to eat at really amazing restaurants and drink great wine. It was really hard work, but we did it. We managed to do it, and we put a couple of records out, and that, you know, it was great. But it's just tough with instrumental music, and you know, it's tough to kind of to really make that work. So it kind of finished at the right time, and then obviously we wanted to make this record with Matt. So that sort of was another, you know, took us into another direction. And it's always great to work with David because he's such a brilliant bass player. So onwards and upwards with that, really. I like to keep busy, you know, keep busy doing sort of new stuff. I don't really, not really one to kind of be, you know, looking back, and I don't like tribute bands and things like that. I mean, you know, each to their own, but it's just not my thing, really. I'd just rather be doing stuff that's just new, really, new and different, and that keeps me interested.
Oh, great. And just touching on sort of back to the Oasis world and with Alan as well. So, I mean, Alan left Oasis in sort of mid-2000s. Was there never the call to you to say, OK, can you come in and you take over, Steve? Was that not an option?
No, it never happened. I mean, you know, as I say, I mean, I've never, you know, I'm actually documented on saying what at the time about what I felt about what happened. And that's kind of the way that I see it. I mean, you know, once Alan was out of the band, you know, he was out, that door shut, and I don't think I'd be the sort of person that would get a call to do it. You know, it's a shame, really. You know, all those doors were kind of slammed shut. I did run into Liam once at a gig and said hello to him, but you know, our collective paths have never really crossed since then, and you know, that's just kind of how things work out. But as I say, I'm still really good friends with Bonehead. We have a sort of mutual catch up every so often, and you know, and Tony, I've sort of stayed in touch with intermittently, and Gwigs, I'm still kind of in touch with him. But you know, I think, you know, there's in amongst all that, there's a lot of doors that got shut, but it wasn't going to be me that was going to come and play drums.
No. And so, I mean, it was Zach Starkey that ended up taking on that role.
Yeah, Zach did it, didn't he? And then I went and played at Live Aid with The Who, which was sort of weird, you know.
Which is amazing, yeah.
Sort of like, it's like Britpop wash swapping or something, you know.
It's all a little bit incestuous, isn't it?
Just a little.
But then, yeah, so that's cool. And so what about, I'm sure our listeners are interested, because Alan was saying it's almost like an issue with the ex-Oasis members. They sort of, Gwigsy and Alan, they've kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. Is Alan above ground? Is he okay, mate?
Yeah, he's doing great, and he's doing his own thing, and he's just kind of not doing music. He's got other things that he likes to do, and he's just not doing music, I just don't think he feels the need to have to talk about it or explain himself. And the media is such a, you know, a strange animal that, you know, I just don't think he feels the need to. I think he feels that his music and his drumming, his contribution to the band, said what it said, and that was it. That's it, really. He's not going to go and do My Story with the Sun or anything like that. He's not. He doesn't want to do a book. He's not particularly interested. You know, I think we both share a healthy distrust for the music business wise. you know, but the difference is that I wanted to, you know, I've gone into other things and kept things going, and Alan's gone into different things. I know he absolutely loved his time with the band, but once that chapter closed, I think he just thinks that was it. And I think people, and I think, you know, I can't speak for Gwigs, but I just think that, you know, people just expect to know everything about everything nowadays, you know. And, you know, why is he not on Twitter? Because he doesn't want to be on Twitter. Why is he not do Facebook? Because he doesn't want to do Facebook. Why, you know, it's almost like it's expected. And I kind of do my bit of social media because it helps to promote things that I'm working on. But not everybody wants to be you know,
absolutely
in that mix, really. And it's not that he's not disappeared off the face of the earth. It's just we just have to accept that there are people that do understand that there was life before Facebook and Twitter. You know,
absolutely. No, that's great. I say, I think it's. The thing with Oasis, as I'm sure you're aware, there's just such a genuine love and passion for that band from the fans, you know, and me doing this, I mean, that's just what comes through so much. There's such a sense of community, whether it's going to the gigs, the anthemic nature of the songs.
Yeah.
And that then feeds through to the members. And so there's a genuine, people are genuinely just like, they just hope they're all right, you know.
Yeah, I completely understand that. And it's absolutely, there's nothing sinister or nothing, you know, it's just that, you know, it finished and people move on, you know.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. And like I say, we with everything these days, we sort of expect a sequel, we expect a reformation, we expect some, can it not just go on for one more, can we not just get one more, can we not just have one more? And it's like, well, you know, no, you had it, and enjoy it in its majesty.
Yeah, absolutely. And Weller did that, you know, never reforming the Jam, never reforming the Style Council, just move on, and that's it.
That's it. And that's why, you know, when I finished with him in 2006, I knew that was it. That's that door shut. He's not the sort of person that goes back, and we're not particularly nostalgia bound. Paul is incredibly busy, and we stay in touch. There was never a falling out between us. We just moved on, you know, and that's good. And I keep in touch via the odd text, and we do exchange little best wishes now and then. But you know, things move on, people move on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I saw on Twitter there's a park bench in Alan's name. In Ellum, and yeah, you haven't got one. What's going on?
I haven't got one. I'm really, you know, I was pretty gutted about that because the bird out the bill that played the desk sergeant, she got one, and you know, it was like, you know, some pretty kind of sort of in, you know, really kind of tenuous links to the local area, and I still live here in South London, you know, so. I might go up there, and my little boys have said we should just go up and paint your name on one, Dad. So
yeah.
I might go and do that with them one night. Just paint my name on a bench in the High Street in Elton.
Do it, mate. Well, I'll come down and we'll film it for posterity. That'll get you trending on Twitter anyway.
Brilliant.
Good. Well, you know what? That's absolutely brilliant, Steve. I mean, I think I'll let you crack on but no, I do really appreciate your time.
Pleasure.
Is there any sort of particular tracks that are favourites of yours, either from your career, other artists that you want me to sort of drop in and play?
I don't know if you wanted to play something, if you can lift the soundtrack off that Greek Theatre thing. Maybe somebody would like to hear something from that. If not, some Family Silver would be good. Or my all-time sort of favourite Oasis track is Acquiesce. I absolutely love that one.
So, oh, yeah.
And if anyone's interested, Family Silver are going to be out doing some dates, tickets on C-Tickets. We're playing at the O2 Academies in Glasgow, Newcastle, Birmingham, Leicester and London in November and December. So come and say hello.
There we go. Great. All right. Well, we've started doing these sort of listener meetups and things as well around things. So that's the sort of thing that we might look to do that. Either London or Birmingham would work really well, I think. So good.
Steve,
absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll speak to you another time, hopefully. But yeah, I do really appreciate it, mate.
Take care, James. Thank you.
Cheers, bye.
How's Boston? Ah. I'm Boston. I'm Boston. I'm Boston for the piss. I got you there, didn't I?
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Here at Ritual, we know that a mother's support isn't limited to one day a year. And we believe that yours shouldn't be either. So this Mother's Day, we're honoring the world's biggest supporters with science-backed daily rituals that center you not just today, but every day. Whether you're thinking about motherhood, actively trying, or already there, we've got you covered for when it matters most. From fertility support and natal choline to our best-selling clinically-backed prenatal multivitamin, know that you're getting clean, traceable key ingredients in bioavailable forms. Because let's be honest, you don't have time for guesswork. Find your ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator as of Q4 2024 in top 5 products.